Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. And if you missed any of my shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Last week, I interviewed Ishai Seton, who showed his film The Kitchen today at 1 o'clock. And also, he showed, which is right now, actually. It's 1 o'clock now. So he's showing it right now at Cinema Paradiso. That was after a chili cook-off of sorts, a chili cooking class that was taught by Michelle over there at Cinema Paradiso. But it also showed last night at Movieco Pompano. So I had a chance to see Ishai in person again. But I interviewed him last week. So if you missed that interview, you want to check it out for The Kitchen. And you can listen to all the archives for all the people that I've interviewed from the film festival and also just directors in general from all over the world. But today I'm interviewing Robert Odonto, the director of Pearls on the Ocean Floor. And I think I have him on the line. Let's see. Robert, are you there?
Hello, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks.
How are
for being
you?
On the show. I'm great. I want to dive right into the movie.
Uh-huh.
This is a very powerful movie about Iranian artists inside and outside of Iran and their point of view on life there. How did you decide to do this film?
Well, my first film explored the world of Chinese contemporary artists, all of whom were living in the People's Republic of China. And I was screening that film at the Hong Kong Art Fair in 2008 and came across the work of several Iranian female artists that would eventually be in my film. And I was really moved by what I saw, and I had been teaching a class on Iran and the Middle East, so I had that background, and I thought, you know what, I know this world to some degree. I can move forward and make this film, and I wanted to kind of provide a richer, more complex vision of Iranian people living in 2009. So that's why I chose to do it. And I thought that looking at women would be unique in that, like, women have kind of bore the brunt of the regime, having to wear the hijab. It was something that they didn't have to wear as early as, like, 1936. But when the revolution happened, in 79, all kinds of, like, family laws had been rescinded, and they were forced to do that. So that was reflected in their art, and I just thought it would be, you know, a win-win situation to interview them and ask about identity, about what it's like to be a woman in Iran, to live away from your home country. And it ended up being a rich ground to explore.
Was it difficult getting the interviews with the women, especially the ones that were within Iran?
No, not at all. I had a lot of success with that first film, The Rising Tide, and so the gallerist, I approached that gallerist then and there in Hong Kong, and she put me in touch with several of them. Some of them I found via Facebook, and then I just started researching and found a couple of books and could get in. They're all artists that are, you know, they're known in the global art scene, so they're all represented somewhere in New York or London or somewhere else in Europe, so it wasn't too difficult.
Did you just travel to Iran and the United States, or did you go all over?
I did go all over. Originally, the first interviews were done in New York City. There was an exhibition, and it was actually 9 days after that election in 2009 when the government basically stole that election. And it was a huge exhibition called Iran Inside Out. It was the largest, most comprehensive show in the United States up until then. There were 50 artists, 25 of whom live in Iran and the other 25 somewhere in one of the Iranian diasporas. So I did some interviews there. I also did interviews in Berlin, in Leipzig, in London, Frankfurt, San Francisco, and Iran. So I was able to kind of go all over the place and get those interviews.
Great. And how long did it take you to make the movie?
1 year. I started it on, I believe it was like June 13th or 14th, which was the opening of that show in New York, and I finished it on June 13th, or the day before that for a screening in San Francisco at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. So I just powered through and finished it. And that's the other thing that makes the film quite unique, is that it's a testament to that time when, you know, long before the Arab Spring, there was that whole uprising, the Green Movement taking place in Iran. And I was kind of within that in some degree because I was connected to all these artists as that year went on, doing the interviews and stuff. And I've stayed in touch with most of them. I actually just did a couple of lectures kind of updating people on three of the artists. And one lives in Iran, one lives in Iran and Berlin, and then the other one's in New York. So I've become good friends with a lot of them.
Did you kind of plan ahead of time how you wanted to put this together, or did you just kind of let it flow as it went along, and did it change over time the way the film came
question.
Together?
Here's the thing. Like, I had taught, I told you, a class about Iran, and as I started to do more research on Iranian contemporary, I kind of used the ideas of Rose Issa, who's a leading curator. She also curates film festivals and kind of a theorist. And in one of the essays she wrote, she said there were four ways or paths in which Iranian contemporary art manifests itself. One of the themes that's really a lot of the artists focus on is, of course, the revolution of 1979. Another is the Iran-Iraq War, which followed a couple of years after the revolution. And then third, if they are Iranian artists living in one of the diasporas, in New York or in Germany or somewhere else, a lot of the artists are exploring a sense of place and time and approaching it via these feelings of nostalgia, trying to, like, reconnect once again with that land that was once theirs. And then the fourth, and the one that to me is the most powerful and the most interesting and the one that specifically speaks to women, is something that Dr. Issa calls the schizophrenic self, meaning a lot of Iranian women have to navigate several worlds within a day. They go from the public private or the public self, which is very private, the world within with women, to the public sphere where they are forced to wear hijab and to cover, and often when they're around men, to look down at the carpet. There's a reference to that in the film. Like, that's what women
should do.
Yeah,
that was really powerful.
Yeah, and I'm very happy with the project. A lot of Iranian women have thought, and a lot of Middle Eastern women have actually thanked me for, like, putting that together, saying you really nailed it. Like, that is what we go through. That is the way we live and are forced to live, and I'm glad that you kind of got that. And they also thanked me because the subjects are all so bright, passionate, funny, reflective, thoughtful, and that's something that I'm glad I was able to present, because often we just see images of Iranian women with their fists in the air and they're wearing a black chador and they're like, they're humorless, they're sexless, they're like just angry people, and that's not true. I mean, so many of them, Shireen the Shot is like a little flame, a bright flame. She's like a butterfly, a beautiful person, and she was the first artist I interviewed, and I knew instantly, like, I was onto something, just because she was so welcoming and earnest and helped me with the film. She helped me get distribution, so it's been a really good experience.
Right. What? Tell me about distribution.
I've got, actually, both of the films are going to be available on IndiePix. They were going to be out earlier. They're not. I haven't got a theatrical release for them, although I'm screening at a bunch of festivals. I actually just got into Doc Miami, which is going to screen on December 8th.
Great.
So there'll be a couple in Southport, Florida, and possibly another one around Art Basel that weekend.
Excellent.
But it'll be available to buy. Right now, I've just been selling copies to different museums, to universities, to libraries. So, but it'll be available to stream, and IndiePix has its own kind of platform where it's something like Netflix, where you pay for a download and you can watch it for a couple of days, that kind of thing. So it'll be available en masse fairly soon.
Okay. Were there any interviews that surprised you, that gave you information that you didn't already know?
Anything that surprised, not really. I was kind of surprised there wasn't more controversy regarding the film. That doesn't mean there hasn't been, but it's been pretty fair sailing. You know, people have come out in droves to see the screenings, and I've often done them with a couple of the artists if I'm in New York, depending where I am, or even with leading academics. Mm-hmm. I've screened the film at a bunch of different universities, and they usually have somebody from gender studies or an art history professor or a film professor join me in the Q&A, and it's always a good discussion afterwards. But nothing really surprising, though.
What do you feel about the changing climate in Iran? Are you hopeful? What did you see when you were there?
Well, I'm very hopeful because I know how enlightened the youth are. Mm-hmm. Unlike some of the countries in the Middle East, like women make up 65% of graduate students, and everyone's college educated, and that's why they did. That's why it was the first Middle Eastern country to take to the streets, because they want a future. And right now the government that's in charge, you know, is so caught up with building a nuclear warhead and all this other stuff of repressing the growth and imagination of these people that eventually they're going to outnumber those religious clerics and be able to reestablish that democratic desire that they have. And I'm not certain how soon it will happen, but eventually it will.
So do you think that it would go back to like a pre-1979 as far as the society goes with women? Or do you think that now, because they've been caught up in tradition and covering themselves and they're kind of going between that and modernity, what is the best possible outcome for women in the future? Can they really just go back to having everything, or do you think there will be some type of tradition mixed in with that?
Well, I think the film points it out. The Baroness Hale Afshar, who's an expert on Sharia law, she's actually comes from three generations of women that rejected the hijab. And when I listened to her, and even in 79, that there was like a feminist critique of the chador and what are the positive attributes it brings when it comes to being a woman in the world and not fearing of being judged as, you know, overweight or objectification of women. So it does cover women and allow them to have some agency in the world, and it has played that role. There are a lot of women, though, that are educated, that have gone abroad, that are living this cosmopolitan life, that will surely reject it. And yet there are some in Iranian society, and I think in the more rural areas and not the bigger cities, that may go for and keep more of a traditional approach to what they wear. But I think largely the women that live in the cities are feeling like they're being held back by it, and they'd rather have a choice. They want it. I think they'd want a choice. I'm sure that they wouldn't want it to be banned, like it is banned in some countries in Europe. And I think they'd always want the opportunity, if they chose to do it, to have and wear it. But I think they'll move towards that rather than, wanting to completely get rid of anything that has to do with Iran or Persian culture.
Yeah. Is there a website where people can find out more about the film and about the artist?
Yeah, you know what? I had a website, and then something got corrupted with it, and I've been trying to get it back through GoDaddy. There are a lot. If they Google Robert Odonto plus pearls on the ocean floor, there are a lot of reviews. There's a great article in there in the Huffington Post that, and they could read about that. That's actually a pretty detailed one. It shows a lot of the artwork. But there, and then there, you can find like three clips that are on Vimeo and a couple that are on YouTube. There's information out there on all the artists that are in the film.
And that we were talking about how this is not your, your first film about art in another country. You did The Rising Tide in 2008 about China.
That's correct.
And that's more about the kind of youth looking at globalization and how they deal with it. So it seems like you've done now, both of these have to do with cultures. What have you learned about society as a whole from doing these projects?
Well, one thing, and it's one of the motivating factors for doing it, is I think that Westerners need to really try to understand the complexities of these places. Both Iran and China are, you know, ancient civilizations that have had great visual culture for thousands of years. You know, Meg Maggio, who's one of the curators in, that I interviewed, and she's in Beijing, speaks about China having 2,000 consecutive years of painting culture. No Western country can say that. And Iran, too, also has had, like, a dialogue with the visual arts for millennia. And so it's really rich ground, but it's both countries kind of remain an enigma because of the current political situations. And in some ways they've also been demonized. And if we really take the time to look at them, you'll find that, and this is why I called it Pearls on the Ocean Floor, that there really are pearls that of culture, of humanity, that we can all see and embrace and gain something from. You know, they don't have to remain something that you see a blur on a news program and, oh, that's those people. There's actually something really redeeming and powerful there.
Besides looking at kind of the beauty of the culture, it also seems that you explore the struggle between trying to find out their identity in a modern culture and mixing tradition with the future. Did you see that it was very similar between the two cultures and how people were dealing with today's society?
You know, that's a great question, because it's one of the things that I guess why I've decided to look via the lens of art and of artists. I just think that humanity at its best, when is humanity at its best? When it's creating, when artists are writing, whether they're writing poetry, novels, writing symphonies, or you know, choreographing a dance, like it's making something powerful and meaningful out of nothing. And I really think that those are our best attributes. Sometimes that process is hampered by political or religious or cultural change, like it is in China, where there's rapid change going on. But that feeds the art. That actually makes the art more dynamic. It gives another edge to it. And that's what I've tried to capture with both films, is to try to show that, you know, that kind of struggle to make meaning in times of great change or suppression, whatever those other forces are that aren't, you know, there to help that process along, the artist knows that he still or she still needs to make that. And it makes it more vital and, I think, more powerful in the end. So I'm actually working on a couple of other projects. One is about artists who were in New Orleans before, during, and after Katrina. And that's called City of Memory. And I'm about halfway through with that one. And the same thing, like it's interesting to see some of the work that they've produced when they were in New Orleans, what they said about it, but then how much Katrina impacted, you know, their sense of person. And it affected their artwork. And I'm really happy with the way this one's coming out. So I'll be
finishing
it.
And you also worked on Darkly Digital? I'm sorry.
Yes, and then that's another film that is looking at what some have deemed the post-photographic. And I'm not looking at a specific culture or a certain place. There are artists from Russia, from Amsterdam, from New York, from Paris, Austria, but artists who are using computer programs, embracing technology, programs such as like Maya and Photoshop, and compositing, manipulating, and bringing together different digital elements towards the finished product. And that, too, will be done in the first part of 2013. I should have two more films done by, I would say, February, maybe before. So
that's great.
Yeah,
that's
great.
How did you get into art? You know, it's, I mean, everything has to do with art with your films. Did you study art originally?
I did. Well, I always drew when I was a little kid. I've always loved the visual arts. I ended up doing an MFA in acting, and I've always, you know, I've always gravitated towards all the arts in a sense. But at first I thought when I was doing The Rising Tide, because I didn't even know I was going to look at art. I was looking more at globalization and China's rise and what different historians and think tank people were saying about the rapid changes sweeping through China and the adoption of capitalism, and with that commercial culture. And I thought that that was really interesting. And then I knew I was going to go to China. I got some money to make the film, and I would have to find some subjects. I got some money, but not enough to spend like 3 months there, that I'd have to do some research and find the people that would discuss the great tumultuous change sweeping through China. And I first thought I was going to look at literary artists, but then I thought, you know what, that's not really going to translate well on film.
Right.
And I started looking, and I saw a painter. I saw the work of a painter, and then I started researching Chinese contemporary art, and I saw the work of Wang Qingsong. And I saw this one photo, and I knew instantly that that was the lens through which I'd explore China's change, because I saw kind of all the complexities, the paradox of a communist totalitarian country that has adopted capitalism. He's got like this one great photo of himself where he's Christ on a cross, but that cross is made of Coca-Cola cans, and all these cellular phones are fluttering, all colorful like butterflies around him. And then I started looking at some other, then another, he's kind of like the Buddha with several arms like Shiva. And in every hand, he's got some accoutrement of the West, whether it's like an Oscar or cigarettes, all these different elements. And I just started researching more and more Chinese contemporary artists and saw that many of them, especially those under the age of 30, were embracing photography and video. Even if they had been trained classically in painting, they felt like, our world is changing so rapidly that the only way in which I can capture life right now is through the camera and through digital photography and video. And I thought that that was really interesting, because those two forms only came about in China with the adoption of capitalism and some wealth and the growth of the middle class. So that's how that came about. And I just thought, you know what, that was a successful film. I'm going to do the same with Iran. Plus, I knew that both of those countries remain enigmas, and there's an interest in them. You know, outside of the art, there's just an interest in Iran. What, like, what the heck is going on there? And I was going to give them a view that we normally don't see.
Right. So how did you get into filmmaking?
Well, documentary. I've done some films where I've acted, but in 2005, I helped a friend, Megan Williams, who's a documentary filmmaker. I went with her to Cuba, and I had been working as a researcher for finding, like, images from different aspects of Cuban culture and history. And I just loved the process. You know, I went when she was doing some of the final interviews. She had gone a couple of other times before. And I just came back from Cuba saying, you know, I'm going to make my own film. I just, like, felt like I could do this. So I went about starting the film that year. I went to China in 2006. It took a couple years to finish that one. So.
And what would be your advice for someone that wants to get into doing a documentary from what you've learned?
If you're working independently, to finish it, to know that you're going to finish it and be committed to that. I think there are a lot of people that start projects and they give up. Or they don't really know what they want to explore, and you should really always be concentrating on that. The other thing is, I mean, you have to need to do a film. If I guess that's why some people stop or don't finish it, because they don't feel like the need to do it, because in the end, you're the only one that's going to make it happen. Even if you have a good friend, a supporter friend, even if they're helping fund a film, if you aren't the one that wants to get it done and know what your vision of making the film is going to be, it's not going to get done. So you've got to really kind of need to do it. And you've got to choose a topic that you absolutely love, one that you can't seem to get enough of or feel that you have a complete understanding for. Because I know that for me, that's the thing that I've always, like, it helps me always want to improve my film as I'm doing it. You know, just reading something, finding out, continuing to do research. I've been fortunate that I've gotten money, but I haven't gotten all the money usually at the very start of a picture. So a lot of times I'm reading all the interviews I can towards these figures that I'm going to interview so that I know what I need to ask them to guide them. Like, for example, I told you I did that research on Rose Issa, and I knew that I was going to ask questions about those four themes so that I could put it together, because I don't like to write narration and tell people. I'd rather have the people from those particular cultures or countries discuss openly, kind of like in a theatrical form, as if it were like a dinner party, and we're talking about a subject, so I could cut back and forth. And it's like, sometimes, as you've seen the film, sometimes people agree on certain things, and sometimes they disagree, or they have a different opinion of it. And I just think it helps to kind of make the discussion a little more complex and detailed. I don't want to say, and this is how the Chinese think, or this is how Iranian women feel. I don't like documentaries that do that, that have that kind of narrator that, you know, sells it to you, tells you what you're going to see, and then tells you again what you just saw. That's not my approach. I'd rather create something a little more nuanced than something that raises questions and forces people to want to know more about them after they've seen the film. Like, my film should just be a launching point to their own personal exploration.
Yeah. It definitely did that for me. It definitely triggered a lot in me and made me want to know more about the artist, for sure. So I think you're successful.
I'm in South Florida. I've got a lot of cool books, all the stuff that I did for research, so you're welcome to seeing some of it whenever. Just let me know. I don't know. I think you're in Miami.
I'm in Boca, actually. I live in Boca.
Okay. Yeah. Well, come to the screening on Sunday or Saturday. No, I'm in Hollywood, actually.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Great. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm sure we'll touch base after this, but we're actually running out of time, and I want to see if there's any other website about any other social media outlet that you want to give about yourself before we go.
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. There are Facebook groups for both The Rising Tide, Pearls on the Ocean Floor, and Darkly Digital. And Divine. I haven't set up one for City of Memory. I'm also on LinkedIn. My last name is spelled ADANN as in Nancy, TO, Robert Adanto. And if you Google my name with The Rising Tide or Pearls on the Ocean Floor. There's a lot of articles about the films, and including the newer ones, because I've done a couple of screenings of like rough cuts in New York, so I've gotten some press already for those.
Okay. Well, excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show today, and I'll probably touch base with you and hopefully bring you back once the other films debut.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, I'd love to have a link at some point. I'd like to see or hear our conversation and be able to pass it on to some people.
I will. I'm going to send Angel a link so that you have it.
Oh, cool.
I'll send it to her, and she can send it to you. And then hopefully
great.
She'll
and
give me your direct email.
Yeah, do you need images or anything?
Or I've already got them. They're already showing
oh,
on the slideshow right
it.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Oh, cool.
Yep.
Well, are we still on the air?
We no. are.
So you have my email. Yeah. I emailed you. I think you were CC'd on a couple this morning. So.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to Facebook you, actually, and that might be the best way for us to talk. But I will do
cool.
that after the show. And thanks for being on today, Robert.
Thank you for having me. Have a good Sunday.
All right.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. You too.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, well, that was our interview with Robert Odonto, and you can see his film Pearls on the Ocean Floor on the 10th, November 10th at 5 p.m., that's a Saturday, at the Sunrise Civic Center, and I would definitely suggest checking it out. If you are at all interested in culture, in Iran, in women's issues, no matter who you are, as a woman, I found it a very powerful film. As we kind of touched on, it dealt with what life was like before the revolution in 1979, which I found very interesting. I didn't know that much about that. How different it was for women back then, how women are trapped between tradition and modernity, how they're objectified, hidden, stifled behind the veil, and even without the veil, how they feel they're made invisible. That he mentioned a reference of women are supposed to look down at the flowers on the carpet when they are around men or in public. And it's an interesting paradox how in the public eye they have to be private, but they can be public and show themselves in private. It's very interesting what's going on in Iran, and I think it affects women in general. It's definitely something that women should watch, and men in general as well, because this is an issue that affects everyone. I found it very powerful. This, of course, is part of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, which is going on through November 11th, and there's even other films on the 12th, and throughout the year, Cinema Paradiso has films. But you want to get out there and see some of these films that are going on right now. I went last night to see a movie called The Sessions with Helen Hunt, and it was amazing. I strongly suggest you see this film. It will have a theatrical release, as far as I know. It is more of a mainstream project. I don't really know the details on it, but it was amazing. It was funny. It was poignant. It was endearing. It was romantic. It was poetic. It's about a man who has polio and is kind of searching out. He wants to have sex, basically. And it's about his search for that. And it's really funny. William H. Macy's in it. It's a great movie, and I really suggest it. And I think people of all ages love the movie that saw it when I was there at MovieCo Pompano last night. I also mentioned The Kitchen earlier in the show with Ishai Seton, which showed today. And that will be on demand and out there soon enough. And you want to check that out as well. That's more of a good film for a younger audience about a party gone wild. And that's kind of an interesting ensemble piece with a lot of great actors. And again, I interviewed Ishai last week, so if you missed that interview, you can go back and listen to it. But if you want to go to the film festival tonight at 6:45 at Cinema Paradiso, they are showing the classic film But Not For Me with Clark Gable and Carol Baker. And Carol Baker will be there. They're going to be interviewing her. Foster Hirsch is going to be interviewing her I don't know whether it will be prior to the film or after the film, but probably both. I'm not sure if I'm going to be out there or not for that, but if you are into classic film and movie history, it would definitely be something for you to go check out. And there's a lot of parties and events coming up, so if you're a filmmaker and you want to network, this is the place to be. You can meet some filmmakers from all over the world. I saw the movie The Playroom the other night with Molly Parker was here and director Julia Dyer, and it was very interesting, dark, dysfunctional film. It's one of those you kind of have to think about a little bit, and if you were alive in the 70s at all, you may relate to some parts of it, or if you're in a dysfunctional family, you might relate to it and find it very powerful. A lot of people really related to the film, and it's definitely more on the darker side. And one of those films that just kind of leaves you going, oh, boy, you know, that's kind of a disturbing situation. So check that out as well. Molly Parker was excellent in it, and I got the chance to meet her. So, again, if you want to go out to the film festival and check out some of these excellent movies that you may not see in the mainstream theaters, then go to the film website, which is www.fliff.com. Also, as always, please go to my Facebook, Indie Streak, on Facebook and like the site so that you can get in the know about some activities and castings and different things that are going on throughout the year. Okay, guys, well, thank you for tuning in. Next week, I am interviewing the director of Sisters Call. That will be next Sunday, same time. So check that out, and I look forward to having the show for you again next week, and thank you once again for tuning in. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.